This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, folks, are we all ready? Jolly good. Well, welcome back, everybody, to the final part of this evening's Bristol Confringe. As regular visitors will know, this is the point at which we put our readers to the question. So we'll get out the thumb screws and the rack and all that sort of stuff and see what we can find out from them. Amanda, if I could start with you. First of all, a historical question. I'm sorry, I'm a history nerd. You know this about me. Who is Pharaoh at the time of the story?
Well, she's the first proper female Pharaoh who took on... Up until she became Pharaoh, she was just, you know, king's wife and king's daughter and king's this, that, and she was all very obedient and everything. And then after her husband died, who was also her half-brother, but let's not go there, she became Pharaoh. And nobody knows exactly why. We just know that there's an inscription in a tomb in, I think, the Valley of the Kings that's... And it says year 7 of the great king Mark-Kare, which is her throne name, may she prosper. And that was kind of the first mention they had, but they don't really know why she kind of went against what they call the concept of Mart, which is balance and everything, why she became Pharaoh. But she had a very, very prosperous reign. She left it in Egypt very wealthy.
Excellent. I was rather hoping you were going to say that. I thought you probably were, because you know there are clearly feminist themes in the book. And up until the arrival of the Ptolemies, Hatshepsut was the only female pharaoh that they had. And also, of course, that magnificent mortuary tomb that she built is absolutely full of references to Hathor.
Yes, it is, yeah, because there was a plethora of goddesses I could have chosen from, but I went with Hathor because she's the female goddess and she's kind of meant to protect women during childbirth and all those sorts of things. And later on in the novel, the chap that Neferu actually does decide maybe she doesn't hate all men after all, he works on the mortuary temple, so... He's doing the painting of the bit where Hatshepsut's mother is led into the birthing room with her tiny little bump and all that sort of thing. So, yes, that's... And I just like, you know, exploring all that kind of thing.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm very much looking forward to reading more about that, because I think that the whole Hatshepsut thing is fascinating. I mean, not only did she become pharaoh, but she had this temple full of themes about childbirth, which, you know, pretty clearly showed that she was putting a female stamp on being a pharaoh. So, yeah, that was good. Now, we know that the Egyptians had flutes, because there are tomb paintings and things of people playing flutes. Yeah. But I was just wondering that, because the music is such a central part of the book, whether you were a flute player yourself, and secondly, if we know anything about how they sounded.
Well, originally I was going to use what they called a sistrum, which was a kind of metal rattle. And I was looking on YouTube, and I heard kind of them, you know, to see the metal rattle. And then a friend of mine sent me something of someone playing an Egyptian flute, because they had the double flute or the single flute, and they're wooden. It's not like she's sat there like that. It's a long tube like that. And I heard it playing, and I was just, So I thought, yeah, she's got to play the flute. She can't play the sistrum. So that was why, even though the sistrum was very associated with Hathor, but there were musicians in the temple, and she just, yeah, I just got carried away by that music, and so does Neferu, so. And so do the goddesses when they hear it.
Well, that's all very fascinating, because both the sistrum and the double flute were traditional instruments of the priests of Cybele, who are a Turkish goddess who became Magna Mater in Rome. So there's all sorts of interesting feminine things going on, and... So, yep, sorry.
Sorry, yeah, Hathor's also goddess of music as well, and the goddess of drunkenness and the goddess of, you know, love and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, there's a, they liked their drunkenness over there. I am drunk to drunkenness. They would proudly announce that. So, yes, so it kind of all kind of ties in. That's why she became kind of the prime goddess, apart from Sekhmet, who also makes an appearance, but she's kind of a sister aspect of Hathor. And so I like that kind of dichotomy as well, because Neferu and Kezi are like sisters as well, so but very different personalities.
Sekhmet is a cat goddess, right?
She's a lioness. She's a Bastet, is a cat, but no, she's a lioness. Yes. Yeah, so Hathor was like a gentle cow mother goddess. And then Sekhmet is goddess of war, goddess of pestilence, but also goddess of healing. So she would, you know, sling the pestilence at people, but also send healing spells as well. So, yes, but yeah, she's a lioness. Savage.
Now, Egyptian religion, I mean, obviously Egypt existed for thousands of years, and Egyptian religion would have changed throughout the period. So at the time of Hatshepsut, clearly Hathor was an extremely important goddess, and Ra, the sun god, you talked about the moon, the boat of the sun. So that's all going on. Now, at the time I'm looking at stuff, we're moving into the Roman Empire. The cow horns of Hathor have appeared on the crown of Isis, and everything has moved a little bit. So it's a fascinating thing, Egypt, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it had obviously 3,000. The Pharaonic period is about 3,000 years long, and Isis had kind of a very different role. In originally, obviously, the wife of Osiris and also mother of Horus and all those different things. And then, yes, I think later on, she was kind of, yes, just kind of absorbed, Isis kind of absorbed Hathor. But there's so many gods and goddesses, just, you know, house goddesses, temple goddesses, and it changed, they absorbed so many outside influences and all this sort of thing as well. So it just changed, and you hear their stories, and they don't really make a lot of sense, but, you know. So, yeah, there's no kind of continuation through it. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it's all very interesting.
Isis, of course, was a mother goddess as well, because she was always shown with the baby Horus on her lap. And by the time that she arrived in Rome, she was also the goddess of the sea. I haven't quite worked out how that happened, but sea goddess she was, and she was frequently shown in a blue cloak, sat there with a baby on her lap. I'll leave you to put that together. Alrighty. So, Tej, turning to you now, being an economic consultant by profession, I have occasionally worked with investment bankers, and I must say that the ones in your story are suspiciously nice.
Yeah, a couple of people whilst just getting a drink there were asking me if I've ever worked in that kind of, and I haven't. But that chapter's a bit of an unusual chapter in that book. Like that, you know, they're not all like that. You know, that there's definitely a political theme throughout the whole book, which Pandora plays her part in, but the other characters sort of contribute to it in different ways, which I won't go too far into for spoilers.
Now, the structure of this, where you've got each chapter told by a different character, that's actually a fairly unusual thing to do. I mean, you see people like George Martin obviously having a whole range of characters, and they come in and come out. So he'll maybe have half a dozen or 10 characters, each of whom will have their own set of chapters. But to actually do every chapter with a different person is quite a challenge. Why did you decide to do that?
Okay, well, it kind of happened by accident. the first two of them I wrote of the Janus cycle, I just thought they were short stories, and then it was when I was at uni, and I just eventually was like, oh, it takes place in the same club, and oh, these characters know each other, and then I think it was when I started writing the third or fourth, I started to realize it was actually a novel that I was writing, and I built more links, and I just like, because the Janus cycle is, it's kind of most of the narrators in that one are quite young, actually, like in their sort of teenage years, and it was a bit of a coming of age novel. And I sort of wanted to sort of explore this idea that they all sort of go through, that they're all very different. I wanted it to be diverse, so all the eight characters have a different gender identity in it. And I wanted to sort of explore that they're all, even though they have like very different backgrounds and different things happen to them, different identity, they all sort of go through similar things at the same time, and I wanted it to be a book that everyone can relate to as well. And when I started writing the sequel, it just sort of made sense to kind of go for a similar format.
You do know I'm in the middle of writing an essay on trans characters in speculative fiction, don't you?
Oh, okay, I can give you an advanced couple of Denusos Rises if you like.
I have actually delivered a first draft. It's due for final draft by the end of the month, but I'll certainly take a look around the first book. And if I think I need the second one, I shall ask you about it. Because, I mean, a lot of what I'm saying, of course, is that the great things are happening, but they're all happening through small presses, because that's where the experimentation takes place. Is that what you found, that it's easier to get that stuff into a small press?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I actually have two different projects. I've got an epic fantasy series, which I'm sort of going to try and get with the bigger presses. That one is actually is quite diverse as well. But this one was, I don't know, it wasn't just the fact that I had diverse representation of the characters, but it was also because it was a novel or a short story, and it was a little bit more on the literary side of genre fiction. I just didn't think it was the kind of thing that big presses would look at, so I just went straight to the indies with it. And, you know, I'm really pleased with Elsewhere Press. They're really good.
Bastards, I'd like to publish that. No, I'm delighted that they're doing a good job for you. Yes, good. Well, yeah, and certainly good to see that sort of stuff is getting published as well. Now, anybody around here got any questions that they would like to ask Amanda or Tej, or shall I just witter on? Justin.
Tej, a quick one for you. Why is it called the Janus Cycle, is it? Where did you get the title from?
Okay, so the nightclub is called Janus. That's where they all sort of meet each other. And, Janus is kind of, he's the god of, like, doorways, like, rebirth, and, like, new beginnings. And all the characters in that, all the narrators in that book, all go on some sort of personal journey which changes them throughout the story. And then I went for Denusos Rises, because Denusos, for the second book, because Denusos is an alternative spelling of Dionysus. It just sounded a bit more like it could be the name of a bar, though, than Dionysus did. And in this sequel, there's kind of like a Bacchic theme going on, which I won't go too much into.
Everybody's getting into my area of expertise. By which I do not mean getting drunk.
Yeah, I can imagine you did a lot of research on that, on the Dionysius.
Well, not especially, because like it's not like a massive sort of theme, and I go into the mythology and stuff, because it is based in modern present day. I mean, I do have a couple of mythical creatures in the second book that are that are Bacchic related, actually. But I did an A-level in Classic Civ. I have a general general interest in ancient history, myth, and so that I pursue my spare time. And when I did my master's degree, I minored in ancient history as well. So I came across, you know, Bacchic themed Greek tragedy and things like that when I was studying. So.
Just talk amongst yourselves, folks, while we have a little private discussion about Menander. Right, yes, no, okay. Did you want to?
I did. Really, it's more of just a general question for both of you about what drew you to writing and fantasy. Obviously, you take fantasy in very different ways, and sort of a contemporary setting and a historical setting. Was there a particular book or author that drew you to into fantasy, and you're like, oh, this is what I want. This is I need more of this, and then I want to create this. So yeah, starting with you, Amanda.
When I started writing fantasy, I was really surprised that I started writing fantasy because I read mostly historical fiction. And I thought, why am I writing fantasy? I don't understand. And then I realised I watched a lot of fantasy. I watched Buffy and Angel and blah, blah, all that stuff. And then and about 25 years ago, like the epic fantasy side of things, I read Raymond E. Feist's Magician. And I also, when I was younger, I liked The Mists of Avalon. I was interested in the Arthurian legend. So I was interested, always been interested in magic. And then in about 1999, my gran said to me, have you heard of this book about this boy wizard called Harry? I knew him before he's famous. And so I was reading things like that. And then when I started writing, it's just kind of where my characters take me, because I sometimes try to write something that's not fantasy, but then I get, for example, I had a few months ago, and there's a woman in her 30s with her daughter waiting for her husband to come and pick her up from, I don't know, a shopping trip or something. This is just how my ideas start sparking. And he doesn't show up. And so the reason why he doesn't show up eventually is because he's been kidnapped by the Fae. Can't be anything normal. It has to be kind of, and it just goes off. And so that's why I write fantasy. But mainly because I just love all the magic. It's great.
Well, I grew up reading a lot of epic fantasy. Like, I started off with C.S. Lewis, and then I went on to Tamara Pierce, and then when I sort of got a bit older, I got into sort of like the more sort of dark, sort of gothic, sort of themed fantasy, like authors like Tanith Lee, Freda Warrington, Storm Constantine. That's more related to my other project. For the thing I read from tonight, my urban fantasy. I don't know. So I read Poppy Z. Bright's Lost Souls, which is actually, I don't know, quite different to my book. But like, it was the first time I read something that was kind of like present day, and also it was kind of quite edgy and very sort of raw. And there's a lot of criticisms that can be made from that book, actually. But it kind of introduced me to that kind of like idea that you can make something like really weird and a bit dark and gritty in the present day. And then as I was writing the Janus cycle, I actually discovered the author who probably is the most similar to what I've been writing, but I actually discovered while I was writing it. So he had a latter influence, and that's Charles de Lint, because when people think about urban fantasy these days, they think of, you know, the vampire stuff that's all come out. But urban fantasy really began with authors like Charles de Lint and was it Emma Bull? Yeah, and And where it's kind of based, it's kind of gritty and particularly with Charles Lind, he focuses on urban bohemia, which is what I sort of ended up going into in my book as well. So it's quite a coincidence I discovered him as I was writing it. So other influence. It might sound a bit weird, but I love Jeanette Winterson, and like I think maybe some of her sort of, I don't know, I don't want to compare myself to her though, because I think her writing is so amazing that I just don't, you know, but like I think she made an impression upon me when I was in university around that time that I was writing. So,
anybody else got any questions? Yeah.
This is for you, Amanda. Obviously, you've done some research into the pharaoh that was around that you've set your story in. Are there any myths or legends from that era from Egypt that you've included in your story?
Not particular myths, although I do talk about the destruction of mankind, which is where the mankind was basically ignoring Ra, who's the father of Hathor and Sekhmet. And Hathor becomes angry, and so she turns into her sister aspect, Sekhmet. And she then starts to cut a swathe through mankind, and the other gods get a bit worried, because if they run out of mankind, there's no one to worship them. And so they filled fields with beer laced with red ochre. So Sekhmet thought it was blood, laps up the beer, falls asleep, wakes up as Hathor, and Hathor's kind of forgotten what she was doing. So yeah, I kind of that myth gets mentioned. So but apart from that, there aren't any other actual myths in there, no. But yeah.
That is a perfect myth for a cat goddess. Anybody else? Yeah, Justin.
Thank you. Amanda, I'm just interested in your conception of magic. When you stood up at the beginning, you said something about you that was your main interest, and you mentioned it just now, that's what catches you about writing epic fantasy. So you said something that the ancient Egyptians, you thought for them it was real. So could you kind of try and elaborate on that? And what do you mean by that? How was it real? How did it turn up to them? Why is it different for us?
Well, it's different for us in that we don't really believe that what's painted on a wall, the images that are painted on the wall, if you did that, it made it so. And say an image of Pharaoh in the temple, because Pharaoh couldn't be everywhere throughout the whole of the two lands, they would have images of him or her painted on the walls, and that way he was overseeing what was going on. And so in this novel, that basically is so, and where the goddesses are as well, they're overseeing, because you couldn't have the actual goddesses coming down, but you have the images of them, and they're kind of overseeing what's going on in the two lands and making sure everything's as it should be. So that's basically.
Yeah, big Pharaoh is watching you. Anybody else? Tom?
One last thing. You both sort of mentioned a lot of your influences and people that you've read. Just as it's January and we're moving forward and everyone's looking for new readers, new things to read, is there anyone that you think's really underrated that you want to champion yourselves, or there's someone that you've discovered that you want to share? So I'll start with Ted.
I guess going back to small presses, one of my favourite small presses in the UK is Iben Vale, and some of their authors are absolutely fantastic, and they're not really very well known. And the thing I like about Iben Vale is they do specialise in doing genre speculative fiction, but ones which are kind of literary as well at the same time. So, and they, particularly Douglas Thompson and Jet MacDonald, they're brilliant authors, and I think more people should read them. And and just small presses in general, because they are producing the stuff that is like, it's not always as refined, but it's generally ahead of the bigger publishers in terms of diversity and trying new things and just being more sort of daring.
There's a couple of people. J.C. Bedford, who I went to a kind of workshop of hers a couple of years ago at BristolCon, and her book Empire of Dust, which is a really good combination, I found, of kind of epic fantasy and sci-fi as well. It's called a sci-tech novel or something, she called it. And but just a really good story as well, because that's the most important thing to me. I'm just interested in story. And Stephanie Burgess as well, who read a few months ago, and I missed it. I was so annoyed. I recently read her Most Improper Magic, which I just found was lovely. It's kind of a Regency magic thing. And I really enjoyed her. So if any of them ever hit the top of the bestseller lists, I'd be quite happy to see that.
Yeah, certainly second Stephanie Burgess. Smoke and Mirrors, I thought, was a marvellous book. I have the new one. I just haven't had time to read it because I've been busy doing research for this essay that I'm writing. But there you go. Anybody got any more questions? And Church, just briefly with you, one of the things that I noticed is that your female characters are really vivid female characters. And that's fairly unusual for a male writer. So well done. And any comments on that?
Yeah, it was something that my lecturers when I was at university commented on as well. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we're at the Janus cycle, because like I was like, oh, I've been told I'm good at writing female and male narrators. And so I kind of showed off a bit with that. And then I was like, oh, maybe I could write some characters or somewhere in between and, you know, like just experiment with, yeah. I don't know why I can do it. I just can. But...
Okay, if there aren't any more questions, we'll get on to announcements. Alrighty, Amanda, do you want to tell everybody about the Egyptian Society?
Oh yes, the Egypt Society of Bristol, they do, for the princely sum of £13 per year, you get to go and see lectures. They're only hour-long lectures. The next one is next Tuesday. They're on a Tuesday evening at the University of Bristol. And yeah, they're quite interesting actually. We've had some pretty good people. We had Salima Ikram a couple of years ago off at Telly. And yeah, it's actually really good. They're really good, interesting people. And through them, I met some other people and, you know, just got to know a lot of people that know a lot about Egypt. And yeah, so it's worth looking them up. If you've got any interest, even the most casual interest in Egypt, it's well worth, because they're really interesting lectures and all sorts of, you know, the whole of the pharaonic period and what's in London and things like that. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
Hello, everyone. I'm a guest. I'm Deborah. I'm a friend of Amanda's. I don't write fantasy, but I do write about climate change and the environment. So I just thought, I honestly did. This was coincidental from something else. I happen to have these in my bag. I'm starting a climate change and environment writing group, and anybody who writes or wants to write about that sort of thing would be very, very welcome. So if you want to get a bit of paper, come and find me. Thank you.
Guess who's got an environmental science degree?
Tom, is the Fringe in here next month?
That's a very good point. I am putting forward a business proposal to the committee this week. So we may be getting upgraded to a slightly bigger venue. That depends on how next Saturday goes. So provisionally, let's presume I fail, and let's say it's here. But optimistically, we may have news next week.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was more of a general wondering. I've got a couple of announcements. Next week in here is the pub night. So I hope you've all come to that. That'll be fun. First pub night of the year, which we'll be staying in here because we like it in here and they let us bring cake. The other thing, just quickly, and I know it's quite short notice, but Crystal Link are currently open for submissions for 3 science fiction anthologies that they're putting together. They're open till the end of the month. There's one on body modification, one on colonising planets, and one on the last day on Earth. So if you've got anything that you think would fit, or you can write anything really, really, really fast, get it into us, because we're closing at the end of the month. So that should be a good one.
Now I'm cursing because I have no time between now and the end of the month. But never mind, I'll have to see what I've got in the trunk. Anybody else got any announcements that they would like to? No? We're all done. I'm doing a whole lot of stuff in February, but the Bristol event for LGBT History Month is going to be on the 25th, and therefore there will be another Fringe before then, so I can remind you all about it at the time. Nobody lives in Exeter, do you, or Bournemouth? No, so I don't need to tell you all about that. Good. Okay, so I think in that case we're done, and we will see you back here on February the 20th. Thank you very much. BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.